The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the hosts and their guests. They do not necessarily reflect the position of any associated employers or organizations.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 6 of the Applied MMT podcast. I'm your host, Adam Rice. Thank you again for listening. In today's episode, Ryan and I talk about the effects of rate hikes, which is a topic we've touched on quite a bit lately. We also talk about the latest economic and inflation data that was released on Friday. Another thing we touch on is the retail inflows into the stock market, interest rates and their effect on asset bubbles and tech valuations, the venture capital boom post-2008, and also gambling and cryptocurrency. Thank you again for listening. If you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe. And with that, we'll get started.
One of the things that kind of came to our attention recently is that the idea, and Ryan and I have talked about this quite a bit in the first, you know, 4 or 5 episodes, the idea that raising interest rates is expansionary is not necessarily consensus within MMT or amongst, you know, the MMT academics. I think it's what Ryan and I tend to believe, you know, based on what we've seen in the data for the past few months. But it's by no means consensus amongst the, you know, the MMT pros or the MMT academics. Ryan, do you want to touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Adam. Like you said, I think we kind of came a little hot in the first couple episodes talking, because we were so excited to kind of be vindicated with some of the data that was coming out. And so we should kind of take a step back and acknowledge that this was a controversial topic, or was and is a controversial topic within the MMT community. And in fact, when I was at the Levy Institute last summer, for the MMT seminar, they didn't really acknowledge the Warren Mosler's view, essentially, that rate hikes are, you know, if the government debt to relative to GDP is at a certain level, rate hikes can be inflationary and pro-cyclical because of the interest income channel and because of what he calls the term structure of prices. And you know, that, so that kind of, to me, the fact that they didn't really talk about that made me realize that, oh, this is actually not a consensus view in the MMT community. And so, you know, when you and I started talking last fall, we were kind of persuaded by Mosler's take, and we were looking at a lot of the data. We were looking at commercial industrial loan growth, consumer revolving credit balances, CapEx, and there were no signs that we could see of that slowing down. And so that was what really turned me on to this idea that, wow, like everyone's got this completely wrong and backwards. With debt to GDP so high, that's essentially offsetting the so-called tightening effects of monetary policy. And so I think it is important for us to acknowledge that for our audience, because there may be some confusion. Oh, wait, is this, depending on who you read from MMT, there may be some disagreement. And so I just, want to, for the record, acknowledge that and emphasize that part of what we're doing here is a little exploratory, right? It's taking what we know about MMT and trying to apply these concepts in novel ways. So I just wanted to make that clarification.
Yeah, that makes sense. So on that topic, on Friday, we got a few data points that were interesting and the market reacted in a big way. So core PCE, core inflation rose 0.6% versus 0.4% expected. And last month's 0.3% increase was revised up to 0.4%. So as a result, the stock market took a pretty big hit. And simultaneously, you know, and this, I think this kind of further confirms our thinking and Mosler's thinking that rate hikes are expansionary. New home sales were up 50,000 more than expected. Consumer sentiment was the highest in over a year. That was according to the University of Michigan survey. And disposable personal income was up 2%. So
amazing.
So we're in this situation where the market is reacting negatively to good economic news. I mean, obviously, inflation is a problem. But, you know, from my perspective, I see no evidence that the rate hikes are doing anything to fix inflation, but they are keeping the economy going, in part at least, because there's other kind of fiscal activity that is, you know, stimulating the economy. But the rate hikes, you know, at this point, I just don't understand it. You know, I don't get what it's going to take for the Fed to say, all right, this isn't working. You know, are they thinking, oh, if we keep raising 25 bips, that's going to do it eventually? I just don't understand what they could possibly be thinking at this point. So it's a strange situation, and I think it's very strange. You know, it's strange how the market keeps reacting negatively to the rate hikes, even though it seems pretty clear that the rate hikes are, you know, stimulating the economy, which should ultimately be good for stocks.
Right. I mean, first of all, it's a little bit scary, I would say. You know, if the Fed does keep hiking, you could do some real damage in terms of inflation, in terms of income distributions, if they go crazy and, you know, take rates up to double digits or up to like 20, 30, 40, whatever percent, then you know, the economy starts to look something like Argentina and Turkey, which has crazy inflation and super, super high interest rates. Right. The thing about the interest rate, I mean, there is somewhat of a truth behind the relative value of the risk-free rate and the return that you can get on stocks, for example. But I think it's way, way overemphasized. And, you know, this is something I think for so long, you know, post global financial crisis, we brought rates down to close to zero. And supposedly this represented loose monetary policy and caused investors to quote unquote, or as Howard Marks likes to say, like go further out on the risk curve. And, you know, this sort of, there is this TINA concept, there is no alternative to stocks, meant that people were irrationally plowing into equities. And as the narrative goes, now that the Fed is hiking, that is starting to unwind. I mean, in general, I do see merit in, like, you know, relative value of, you know, a risk-free treasury bond and owning a company, right? If you're paying 20 times earnings for a company, you know, that's a 5% earnings yield. That, it, you know, if you could get 5% risk-free by buying a treasury, that does seem a little rich. You have to be confident that that company can grow their earnings to sort of justify the risk you're taking, right? Because the treasury is theoretically credit risk-free, whereas you know, the company's earnings, you know, depend on the actual operating performance of the business. So right. from a relative value perspective, you know, to an extent, there is some validity there. The problem that I have with this, well, many problems with this narrative, is that you know, when interest rates are at 0% or whatever, I mean, no self-respecting Wall Street analyst that I've ever met ever said to themselves, oh, hey, you know, let me update my model, my discounted cash flow model that I use to value this equity security. And, you know, because the 10-year is now at 1%, the rational input discount rate for my discounted cash flow model is 1% because that's the risk-free rate. It's like, no self-respecting analyst does that. I mean, that's literally, like, this is so common that we hear about that, oh, you know, stocks for years, like, stocks are going up because the Fed is taking rates lower, and that means that, you know, the present value of the future cash flows of the company need to be discounted at a lower rate and therefore result in a higher valuation today. It's like, no one on Wall Street, that's a sucker's bet if you're putting in 1%, you know, as your as the risk-free rate, as your discount rate for you know, analyzing an equity security. No one on Wall Street thinks that they're a sucker.
Right.
So in your head, you have this, you know, this hurdle rate, this discount rate, whatever you want to call it. You know, I mean, a lot of people I've spoken with over the years have said, you know, on average, given a long-term average, treasuries, you know, would pay around 5% or something. So that can be kind of like a floor with regards to what kind of discount rate I'm using. And yeah, sure, there is something to be said about, you know, the financial engineering of, well, you know, I mean, there were junk bonds issued at, you know, a sub 3% in 2021. And so, you know, if the company's interest costs are going down, that there is a real impact on that sort of cash flow model that you put together and stuff. But overall, like, that is the exception than the norm. Overall, I would say it's just a completely false narrative. It's this weird, like people turn their brains off almost when they throw this narrative around that, oh, this is a what's the meme, Adam? It's like, oh, this is a result of 0% interest rates. It's like a meme that's been going around.
Phenomenon.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So there's two points I want to make that we were talking about before we started recording. One is that, so post-financial crisis, pre-COVID, all the central banks were wondering why, you know, there was no inflation anywhere with very low rates, with near zero rates. And now they're raising rates and inflation is continuing. I mean, it's come down, but it's higher than we would like. And they think the solution is to keep raising rates, which seems totally backwards to me. And then on the topic of, you know, this idea that, you know, things like equity valuations and all these asset bubbles like cryptocurrency and, you know, you name it, were a result of zero interest rate policy. Look at what's going on today. You know, we've had the fastest rate hikes, I think, since Volcker in the past year. And crypto, like Bitcoin, is up 40% year to date. and you know, another meme was, you know, people are still saying this stuff, that, you know, all the retail investing that was going on during the pandemic, like the GameStop stuff, the Bed Bath & Beyond stuff. The meme stocks. Everyone was saying that was a zero interest rate phenomenon. And I just saw an article the other day that retail investors are pouring a record $1.5 billion per day into the stock market. That's the highest it's ever been. So, like, retail inflows into equities are higher than they've ever been. And this is after the rate hikes.
Right.
So, like, it's like, the theory is just totally disconnected from what's going on, you know, in the data and in the real world. And I don't understand what it's going to take to kind of, you know, break this, this cycle, or break this way of thinking about interest rates, because it's totally contradictory to what's actually happening.
Right. And it's just, it's so intellectually lazy and dishonest. That's what really annoys me about it, is people just turn their brains off. They don't even question. It's like, oh yeah, you know, Fed, the stock market's up because the Fed is taking rates lower, or people think the Fed's taking rates lower. Backing up for a moment, because I was very curious about all this stuff, you know, for years. And yeah. I come from a finance background that's, you know, kind of looking at companies, fundamentals, cash flow, earnings, et cetera. And, you know, for a while, there were renowned, professional Wall Street money managers who were getting completely run over because they were short some of these high-flying VC-funded tech unicorn stocks that would, you know, go public or what have you. Or they just vastly underperformed because they weren't invested in them, because according to the sort of the traditional framework of investing, where you're looking at a company and you know, it's got to be profitable and generate cash so that it can so it doesn't go bust, right? Because theoretically, they can't just keep raising more, doing more and more equity fundraisings. They were just getting completely smoked because they weren't invested in this stuff. And every time, you know, I read about it, I talk to people about it, they say, oh, this is because of low interest rates. This is because of QE. The Fed is injecting all this money and they're providing all this liquidity and they're pinning rates irrationally low, and it's calling all of this irrational exuberance and all this other stuff. And my problem with that explanation is there's no clear channel of Fed activity and quantitative easing and, you know, private venture capital investors, injecting equity capital into these fast growing tech companies. Those VCs don't have accounts at the Fed.
Right.
And these were equity finance. They weren't debt finance. They weren't getting loans from banks to pay for. Nobody could give me a clear answer about where the money is coming from, because theoretically they have to run out at some point. Here's a crazy statistic. I think Uber's accumulated deficit, right? So on its balance sheet, you could see kind of the paid in equity capital, and then below that, normally for normal companies, there's a retained earnings balance. If the company over its life hasn't generated net profits, then it has an accumulated deficit instead of retained earnings. The last time I checked, Uber's accumulated deficit was $29 billion. That means that Uber, over its life, has lost, on a GAAP basis, $29 billion.
Right.
So it's crazy. So when you think about it, you're looking at it and you're saying, at some point, if you don't understand MMT, you have to think that at some point, the money train runs out. The venture capitalists can't keep pumping money into this. The public investors who bought it at the IPO, they can't continue to raise equity capital. The lenders, they do have some high yield debt. The lenders are going to say, no, we're not going to continue to finance this. The only way that the only reason they did finance it is because you have a large equity market capitalization underneath the debt, that would come higher up in the capital structure. So theoretically, that high market value is currency that the company can use to raise additional capital. So, getting back to what I was saying, I was just curious about, I didn't understand where the money keeps coming from. Why is it such that it seems like people can just keep, these companies can just keep raising equity capital and their investors never seem to run out of money?
Yep.
And so I want to share a quote from this book by Wynn Godley. And I think his partner's name is Mark Lavoie. And so here's a quote. It says, "The key factor is that as households increase their consumption, their money balances fall, and so do the outstanding amount of loans owed by the firms. Similarly, as households get rid of their money balances to purchase newly issued equities by firms, the latter are again able to reduce their outstanding loans." So I share that quote because when you think about it, and we saw this happen in the the post COVID sort of mania that we had. There's essentially two, like, businesses have to constantly incur and then pay down debt, right?
Right.
If you trade debt, whatever it is. I mean, maybe you have to borrow a loan or money from a bank to finance, you're building a factory or something, or it's just like regular trade debt, like accounts payable, right? You have employees. You have to pay them. You purchase goods from a supplier, you have to pay them back. So that's how the economy works, or how businesses work. You're constantly incurring and canceling debts. So what this is saying is there's two ways for a company to access cash that can cancel debts. One is by increasing your sales, and the other is by raising equity capital. And so, just using that as sort of a mental framework, we need to then look at what was happening, basically for the last 20 years, the fact that we ran, since 2000, we have run a budget deficit every single year. Right. And so that when the government runs a budget deficit, that ends up in, private sector bank balances to be higher. Right. It's a surplus for households and firms and municipalities when the government runs a deficit. So to me, it's very clear that was the source of cash. And so the way I kind of the analogy, and tell me if this is if you have a better analogy or something, but the way I kind of think about it is like a sink, right? You turn the faucet on, the water flows through. That is the government essentially turning on the money spigot, so to speak. The pipes underneath are like the institutional structure, and that affects where the money flows to. So when we think about that, we ran deficits. I mean, the last time we ran a surplus was 2000. That also happens to be when the original tech bubble popped. And then in 2022, again, we had this situation where we had a rapid fiscal tightening, right? The record tax receipts at the U.S. Treasury. And once again, the tech bubble popped. In 2022, I think Tesla was down 60 or 70%. Meta was down like 70%. A lot of these SPACs and these unprofitable companies were down. I mean, Carvana was down like 96% or something. Like it was like just Blue Apron. I have a soft spot for Blue Apron. I have to admit. I'm still a user of their product, which I know is a little crazy. So, another, I mean, just all so many of these things that have the real, you know, WeWork blew up, all these things got completely smashed, and all the EV stuff. Anyway, that was not like they actually started to kind of roll over actually in the fourth quarter of 21, which was the start of the new fiscal year and represented a much bigger fiscal tightening. And so the way I think about this boom in VC funded, you know, tech unicorns or what have you, and then, you know, both private markets and public markets, is you had this constant new stream of cash flowing into people's bank accounts for decades after the Clinton administration, and the institutional structures, the forces in our political economy were such that they were flowing to these venture capitalists who were then funding new companies who, you know, a lot of them were like direct to consumer brands, right? Like Casper Mattress or like Blue Apron, like we talked about. And how do you grow a brand from scratch? Well, you essentially have to, pay marketing rents. It's basically like a toll paid to Facebook and Google, right? That's the only way to get the scale that would be necessary for these companies to meet their fixed costs and then eventually attain profitability. So you had this sort of cycle where, you know, new VC funds would be launched. They would provide these new companies with fresh equity capital. They would then go spend it on marketing and advertising on Google and Facebook. Google and Facebook, right? The FANG stock, part of the FANG stocks, grew tremendously in the post, in the last 20 years, but also, you know, post global financial crisis. It was like the only real source of growth for a long time in the economy were these tech stocks. So people get excited and they keep plowing more and more money, saying, wow, look at Google, look at Facebook, you know, I want to find the next one of that. So there's this sort of constant cycle of, you know, VCs funding new companies, and then the funds flow to Facebook and Google for marketing and advertising, and you know, that enriches Google and Facebook shareholders who then can sell their stock and leave and start their own VC firm or their own startup. And so it's this whole sort of cycle that didn't get stopped until the federal government tightened its belt in 2022. And all of a sudden it popped. The fact that is not even part, like it's not even in consideration for the narrative of explaining the events. No one talks about it in on Wall Street. I don't hear. I mean, you're in the VC tech world. Like, does anyone talk about that?
No, it's all interest rates. It's, you know, I thought, you know, just going back to the institutional structure thing, I thought of a good it's like you look at something like cryptocurrency. So like, as I mentioned, Bitcoin is up 40% this year, right? And this is in wake of these rate increases. To me, this would be like looking at something like sports gambling. So obviously there's been this proliferation of, you know, legalizing sports gambling, and all these apps are out there now to gamble just from your phone.
And it's horrible. It's destructive.
It's horrible, but it's very destructive. But to me, this is like looking at that phenomenon. So let's say that's happened over the last 5 to 10 years, right? Where this massive proliferation of legalized sports gambling. Obviously, there's going to be huge inflows into those apps and into the gambling industry in general if the institutional structure allows for it. It has nothing to do with interest rates, right? It's like This, like, to me, this would be like looking at sports gambling, let's say a chart of inflows into sports gambling apps, and saying, oh, it must be because of QE. You know what I mean? Like, the reason these gambling apps, there's so much volume now compared to 10 years ago, is because the institutional structure has changed. The reason that cryptocurrency, you know, the market caps, these cryptocurrencies, and just all the trading activity, the reason it's exploding is because of the institutional structure, because we're allowing it to happen. It has nothing to do with QE or with zero interest rates. It's because we're allowing these entities to exist. These businesses now exist. There's money to support their existence, and they're legal. Like, that is that's the answer. It has nothing to do with Fed liquidity. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, I mean, we've been repealing laws that, like, this. None of this is possible without actually repealing, like, gambling laws that had been in place for decades, if not centuries. That's what you mean with the institutional structure. We're changing the law, and that is affecting capital flows. I mean, it's not rocket science. I read this really fantastic book called The Code of Capital. I don't remember the author's name is escaping now.
I read that. Isn't that Katrina?
Did you?
Katrina,
yes,
Pizor? I did. Dude, yeah. Katerina Pizor,
yeah. Yes, that's it. One of the best books I've ever read.
Yeah, and it's a great book.
The point that she makes is that, like, oh my gosh, highly recommend, is that, like, things like property rights, intellectual property rights, land rights, what have you, that is a massive source of economic value. I mean, if you think about it, right, there is no such thing, like, a business can't exist unless it actually exists in law. Right. I mean, I think you've launched businesses before. I launched a business last year. You actually have to go. I mean, mine exists in the state, you know, registered in the state of Connecticut. You actually have to go and, like, file paperwork and have the legal entity created. Right. The term corporation is derived from the same word that corpse is. It's in reference to a body. Right. Because it only exists in law. It doesn't exist elsewhere. So the actual existence of a business is a creature of law, not of anything natural. So any sort of, I mean, if the government decides that, you know, they're going to, you know, they're going to allow patents for drug companies to exist for 10 years instead of 5 years, well, guess what? Those patents are now way, way, way more valuable than they were before. Right. Yeah. The only reason that there is economic value there is because the intellectual property right gives you a legal monopoly over selling that drug.
Right.
Or if, you know, I remember I got in an argument with someone, and they made some obnoxious comment about, oh, you know, the government is so stupid and they're going to screw up the energy policies like they always do and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just going to sit here and collect my oil and gas royalties. I'm like, okay, let's take a step back, bro. Your nice little oil and gas royalty stream is only valuable because there's a contract that is enforced by the government for you to collect on those royalty streams. It literally does not. If you buy a house, I mean, we bought a house back in 2021. There is no equity in a house if the government doesn't actually acknowledge and enforce your right to own the property, right? Someone can't come onto our property and just, you know, stick their flag onto the land and declare it theirs, right? We call the police and have them thrown in jail, right? And if they try to sue and say, no, this is my property, the judge will say, no, that's these people's property. They, you know, they have legal title to the land. This is a public handout. It's the ultimate subsidy is having a court system that enforces contracts and a Congress that grants property rights. So, and writes it into law. So so much of the discussion, I'll never forget. I was on, on Bloomberg, right? It's like where all the Wall Street people, use Bloomberg, whatever. I was on this anonymous distressed, chat conversation thing. And I got into it with someone who they were complaining about, you know, and again, going back to the low rates thing, they're like, oh, you know, the government is inserting itself into the, is influencing the price of securities and they need to stop interfering in the markets and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, dude. And I'm sure it was a dude because there are almost no women that work in distressed debt. No one held a gun to your head and said you need to get into distressed debt investing. You did this because you wanted to do this. And when you buy debt of a distressed company, frequently your investment outcome is ultimately comes down to the whims of a judge in a bankruptcy Chapter 11 situation and how they divvy up, how they interpret contracts and divvy up the assets amongst the competing creditor claims. So literally it comes down to a judge, and you're going to sit here and complain about governments influencing securities prices. They don't think about that.
No, definitely not. And it's like, you know, it goes. It's the same thing with the companies I was just talking about with like these entire industries, like these sports gambling apps exist because they're allowed to exist, and we've made the decision to make them legal. You know what I mean? And whether that's a net good or a net bad is a different question. But the structure is set up so they're legal, so we should expect that people will now start putting money into them. And it's like cryptocurrency, like the retail inflows to the stock market, for example. Is that a consequence of QE and interest rates? Or is it the fact that, you know, is it a fact that there is a plethora now of these consumer apps that encourage people to gamble on the stock market constantly, right?
Right, right.
Like that to me is the obvious.
And they also have excess savings from interest rate hikes.
Yes, that's part of it too. But it's because we have this institutional structure now where anyone can create a stock trading app like Robinhood, and you can encourage your everyday retail investor to gamble on the stock market as much as they want using instruments they might not understand. That's the reason that we're seeing these retail.
Definitely don't understand. I mean, the shenanigans that Robinhood has pulled, you know, with making default, you know, making margin accounts people's default settings, and you know, encouraging people to trade call options. It's disgusting. It's a perverse form of capitalism. I mean, this whole, you know, we were kind of talking about, again, thinking back to the, the flow of funds, and, you know, we ran deficits every year, and that replenishes money into the economy and grows the account balances. Another huge source of funds was the, the so-called tech unicorns, was the Vision Fund, the Masasone's, SoftBank Vision Fund. Yep. The anchor investor in the Vision Fund was the Saudis. Right. Where did they get the funds from? Well, you know, I pulled up the statistics. So, So let's say, you know, from 2000 to 2014, on average, we ran a $22 billion trade deficit with the Saudis. So presumably, we were importing oil and paying them with dollars. So $22 billion per year. Since then, right, and 2014 is noteworthy because the energy price collapsed that year. The high yield market got killed because it had funded the shale revolution. And, you know, because of the huge increase in capacity for drilling oil in the United States, that crushed the price of oil. And so we no longer needed to import as much. So, you know, from 2014, $22 billion per annum. Since then, it's averaged $3 billion per annum. So, I mean, but that was a huge accumulation of funds for the Saudis. And so, you know, and with the price collapse of oil and stuff, they wanted to, you know, diversify their economy, you know, in case they can't make all this money from oil anymore. So they hired Masa Sohn to run this Vision Fund, and it was like $100 billion. And so he would go around and meet Adam Neumann and like the way he looked or whatever, and so said, okay, we're gonna give you a $47 billion valuation.
Right.
That has nothing to do with interest rates. Right. Absolutely nothing. And in fact, I mean, WeWork ended up, I mean, their IPO blew up in 2019, right? This $47 billion valuation was absurd, and the public markets kind of threw up all over it. They ended up going public via SPAC. And I mean, I think today, you sent it to me the other day. What is it? It's like $1 billion market cap now. Is that right? Or
yeah,
it lost a billion?
I think it's actually under. I think it's under $1 billion. So they've raised $22 billion to date, and the company is now worth about $900 million.
That's pretty impressive. I think if somebody just handed out $22 billion to you and I, we could probably do better than that.
I agree. Just, at least yeah. I would hope so.
Yeah, but you know, and I think like a year ago it was around it like $5 billion market cap or something. So again, a year ago rates were still pretty close to zero, and in 2019 they were at 3%. So a year ago I was kind of pounding the table on this. I'm like, this interest rate narrative is total BS, because I think the 10-year was around 3% in 2019, and WeWork had a $47 billion valuation. Now it had like at the time, this was a year ago, it had like a $5 billion valuation, and rates were at zero. So
right.
I just, there's just no intellectual honesty when people make these arguments. And the much, much more rational argument is that there were changes in institutional structures or changes in laws. You know, while we did run deficits post financial crisis, there's a pretty strong case to be made that we way underinvested in our full economic capacity, and that's why we had such low growth for so long. That being said, you know, tech was one part of the economy that was kind of booming, and it had people excited. And so a lot of funds flowed away from sort of more traditional economy companies and into these, you know, exciting new tech companies. And a big function of that is just the fact that, you know, we had this supposed hangover in the housing market, and you know, factories were shutting, and we were outsourcing to China, and you know, really sort of, you know, there wasn't any growth left in the traditional kind of industrial economy, but there was a lot of growth potential in the tech sector. Which, right. By the way, for the record, I have like a little bit of a problem. I know we've talked about this. I have a little bit of a problem with the characterization of some of these companies as being tech companies. If you're if your primary source of revenues is advertising, you're in media. You're a media company. You are not a tech company. And you know, speaking more about the institutional structure, right? The whole Section 230 provision that essentially serves as a legal carve out for internet companies to not have to adhere to the same standards as traditional media publishers. That, to me, is a huge explanation for the explosive growth in Facebook and Google, because and Twitter, frankly, because they weren't treated like traditional publishers, and so they didn't have to play by the same rules. They didn't have to they didn't have any standards for what got published on their platforms. That being said, there are many instances, as we have found out, where these companies, and this is not a political right left issue. It kind of went both ways. The company clearly showed that they were pressing their thumb on the scales on information that got disseminated. They weren't acting as a passive platform. They were an active participant in terms of influencing the information flow. And I just think that has come to a head, and I think people have started to realize that. And now there's a lot of questioning about whether the rationale of the Section 230 carve out continues to make sense. And I think it's actually being litigated in the courts, and the courts are kind of are going to end up saying, like, listen, this is a Congress issue. Like, you guys just have to, if you want to change this, you got to rewrite the laws or whatever. I don't think these Supreme Court justices, frankly, even really understand. Don't even use these apps. Like, it's hard enough for them to understand it. But anyway, getting back to the point is that, yeah, if you have companies that don't have to play by the same rules as everyone else, then yeah, they're going to obviously perform a lot better.
Unfortunately, we ran into some technical difficulties at the end of our recording here, so we're going to cut the episode there. Thank you again for listening. If you are enjoying the podcast, please subscribe. If you're watching on YouTube, it'd be great if you could like and comment on the video. Thank you again for listening, and we will see you next time.